All right, good afternoon, everybody. It is Thursday afternoon, April, 15th, 1240, and we're doing Chem 12B. And today, I think this is the final day that I want to do on spectroscopy, and I want to move on next week. Yeah, final day on spectroscopy. And then we'll move on next week to some more of the chemistry. We'll get into carbonyl chemistry and look at new ways of making carbon-carbon bonds and all the different types of reactions that we can do with carbonyl chemistry. We'll get into enolates and more organometallics and all kinds of really good reactions coming up. So also aromatics, paracyclic reactions, all kinds of really, really cool topics. I think the next thing that we really launch into, I think that the next topic right after this is aromaticity, and looking at aromaticity and defining what aromaticity is and what aromaticity isn't. So lots of great topics coming up next week. And today what I wanted to do was sort of one more problem from beginning to end. For those of you who are in the afternoon lab, the morning lab, we wound up doing a little bit more mass spec work, and we did one more full problem with IR, NMR, mass spec. And it turned out to be a really good NMR problem. It was, I think it was Kelly's suggestion to go through and do a more difficult NMR problem. And it turned out to be a really good one, which you guys are gonna get to see, I think, because I have a doctor's appointment this afternoon, which is gonna take me away from lab this afternoon. So I'm gonna try and get that morning lab up so that you guys can go and watch that if you so desire to do that. Or if you wanna spend the time working on the quizzes, and logging in and using some of that afternoon lab time to work together and to coordinate together to do the quizzes, that would be a great use of time as well. So that'll give you some options. Let's see, what else do I want to tell you? I did some work in the Canvas shell, and so there's a little bit more stuff up in the Canvas shell now. I've got another module up for mass spec, a new co-op up, which is a spectroscopy co-op, which deals with all three forms of spectroscopy, and another quiz that's up that is just a mass spec quiz that has just unique mass spec things. So it's not a whole integrated problem. And that gives us two quizzes that I've put that are due for Monday. So you have an NMR quiz that is due for Monday, and you have a mass spec quiz that is due for Monday. And I wanted to talk about those two for a minute because there was some questions as to, wait, you put two quizzes due on the same day. I know I put two quizzes due on the same day. But each one of those quizzes was designed to be a 15-minute in-class quiz. And so all said, I'm sort of thinking that if you're working together and you're solving those problems together, that maybe it would take you an hour as a group to kind of bang out those two problems. Particularly the mass spec one is really simple because you're not trying to do a structural ascertainment. You're not trying to figure out what the structure of the molecule is. You're just going from the mass spec and figuring out the right formula and then doing a couple of alpha cleavages and a McLafferty cleavage. So that should go pretty quickly. Excuse me. The NMR quiz, admittedly, might take you a little bit longer depending upon how much studying you've done in the NMR and how fast you're clicking through the NMR. So, and those due dates, as always, they're a little bit flexible. So remember that I program them in, but if you happen to turn something in late, I don't count it as being late. It gets marked late in Canvas, but I don't deduct any points for that. And you're still welcome to turn it in, and I will grade it and assess it. So if you need some flexibility and more time to get any one of those quizzes or both of those quizzes done, you've got it. I just wanted to give it, I wanted to give you a gentle nudge because I want to do the second exam on the week of the 25th. And so I don't want you saving everything to the last minute and then not feeling like you had enough time to study for that exam and not being prepared for that. So that's the idea there, is bringing that second exam in the week of the 25th. Same sort of format. Sterling?
The second exam would be like NMR, mass spec.
It is an exam that is just NMR, mass spec, and IR. It's just spectroscopy. There's nothing else that's in there other than spectroscopy. And so the way that that exam is designed is similar to the others in that there's a first part and a second part. The first part is all the individual skill sets. So it has you do some alpha cleavages. It has you figure out a molecular formula. It has you look at an IR and tell me, you know, what you see in the IR. It has a small NMR problem or pieces of an NMR problem that says, what is the splitting pattern, or how is this, how are these protons linked together? What is the, you know, is there a methyl, is there a a CH2 group, or what how are they connected? So those are all the individual skill sets. And then the second part is one single problem where it is the overall thing, where you get an IR, a mass spec, the proton and the carbon NMR, and any details of those NMR that I want to give you. And then you solve the structure. But there aren't options. It's not like there's three problems to choose from. There's only one problem, and everybody gets the same problem, because otherwise it's just too overwhelming. There'd be too many pages and too much spectra and too much overload. So one problem, everybody gets the same problem. You all work through the same problem. This is usually a very high scoring exam, even when it's done in class, because I use the rubric, that spectroscopy rubric, to score it with. And because you guys have the rubric and use it as a sheet for checking off each of the pieces of data, it usually comes together pretty darn well. Not everybody solves it and gets the right structure, but usually, because I'm grading more on process than I am on the correct answer, on the final answer, this is generally a pretty high scoring exam. So I'm not overly concerned about that. Will our final be collaborative also? Yes, absolutely, because that's the way we roll around here. A word about that too, maybe, which is kind of nice, is because I have definitely been feeling like the odd man out in terms of the chemistry department, and my feeling on collaboration and exams. And everybody else is putting out tremendous effort to try to figure out how to lock down the exams, how to prevent people from working together, how to lock down the browsers so that you can't even Google anything on the internet, how to get it, not to put it on Chegg, and just an enormous amount of effort. And there are companies that are making millions of dollars now touting all of these different ways to lock down the browsers and to prevent students from cheating. And I don't want to out any of my colleagues. I'm not going to talk about anybody by name, but when we have meetings, a lot of the meeting is talking about how do you prevent cheating and how do you prevent them from working together and how do you assess individuals? And I just keep my mouth shut because I'm like, it's working for me and I'm happy with the way it's working. And I think that it makes a more collaborative dynamic in the class. And that's what I want. And recently, the college has been putting out some information touting having students work together more than trying to lock things down. And there's all of these studies that are showing that trying to lock things down doesn't really work anyway. And all you're doing is just making an adversarial game where everybody's just trying to work around it. And it puts more stress on the students. And we're already stressed enough as it is with Zoom and everything else. So I'm still comfortable with the way this is working, and I would continue to encourage you to work together. So is it a trend that's going to go forward in upper division? Probably not. When you get to graduate school, yes. When you get to graduate school, because they recognize that you need to work together. And even when I was in graduate school, it was amazingly collaborative. I mean, we would get assignments, particularly on what they called there was a set of exams, cumulative exams, that we needed to take in your first year of grad school. And you're given something like 6 topics and 12 papers in each topic. And you need to read all of those papers for every topic and be prepared for any question within that anywhere. It was more than any one person could read. And all they did was just give you the papers. And at that point, there wasn't the web where you could just download the papers. You had to go to the library and look up those papers. And so the grad students all just like, I'll take those. And then we all split up and we went and we photocopied them for everybody else. And we came back together and we shared them and spread them all around. And we just all worked collaboratively in order to tackle those assignments, because that's how you get things done. And no one person is an expert in every area. And so relying on your friends and your colleagues who have expertise. I mean, when you're working in research, you walk down the hall to the guy who knows NMR when you've got a particular NMR problem and you're working in biochemistry and NMR is not your strong suit. You go to the guy who knows how to do NMR and you say, I need some help. If you need computational chemistry, you go down to the computational chemist. If you need biochemistry, you go over to the biochemistry section. I mean, we work collaboratively. And that's where our strength comes from. So learning how to do that, I think, is an important skill set. And I wish more people did. So anyway, that's my, I got to get off the soapbox. Once in a while, I'm up on my soapbox again. Okay. Yeah, get good at references too. All right. So that's all I wanted to say on that, I think, in that, yes, the final will still be collaborative. You guys will still work together. That's just the way we're going to get through this class. And yeah, you're basically ready for the real world. Okay. That's good. You know, what is a grade supposed to reflect? A grade is supposed to reflect your ability and knowledge base and ability to work within that area. And if part of that is reflecting your ability to work with others, then that's something that people are interested in as well. And if you can work collaboratively and you are a colleague that people can work well with and trust and rely upon, that is an extraordinarily valuable thing to know as well. It's as valuable as somebody's ability to be able to do an individual job. So I'm going to collaborate on your taxes. Okay. Yeah, they extended that deadline. So if you're worried about taxes, that deadline's been extended a bit. I can't remember exactly what that new deadline is, but it's not April 15th. So
it's May
5th. Yeah. I think it was a month. They extended it out a month, which is pretty nice. Yeah. Okay. Let's get back on topic. Let's do some work here. Let me screen share. Come on, click in. Be patient. No, not working. Nope, clicked in. There. I'm learning to be patient. It's my impatience that I just keep clicking the screens and then it doesn't actually do what I want it to do. All right, we've got an IR here. So this is an all-in-one problem. That's what we'll call it. We've got mass spec, NMR, IR, and proton and carbon are included in there within the NMR. So here's the IR. And along with that IR, I have to stop the share. I'm gonna go grab the rest of the spectra so that I have all the spectra and then I'll come back. So take a good look at the IR, think about what that could be. And I'll pause it for a second and I'm gonna go back and grab the rest of the spectra. I don't want you to see which problem I'm going back and forth with. So this will take me just a second. It's not too bad. Don't need those, but I do need that. Oh, that's pretty. So there's a couple of details that I'll need to grab here. And then I got to grab the mass spec because we'll need that. I know, why didn't I do this all ahead of time? Because I was resting my back. I should have done this ahead of time though. But I'm getting faster at it. Okay, while I'm doing this, I'm gonna tell a little story. I got one more piece of data to grab here. And that story is, I believe it's a story out of India, sort of like a proverb, where an elephant walks into town, and there are several blind men who are asked to figure out what the animal is. And they all go to the animal and they all examine different parts of the animal so that all these men are blind. And one of them grabs the trunk and says, this animal feels like a very thick snake. And another one is touching his ear and says, no, this animal is strange. It has this very big, flat, soft area. And another one grabs the foot and says, no, this animal is built like a tree. It's enormous and it's very strong. And another one grabs the side and says, no, this animal is built like a wall. It is just insanely big. And every one of them has a piece of what that animal looks like, but they don't together, unless they work together, figure out what the overall animal looks like. And this is like the different forms of spectroscopy, that when we look at the different forms of spectroscopy, if you look at any one of them can be extraordinarily misleading and not give you the right thing. And yet when you take them all in totality, it's not until we look at each piece of data and bring each piece of data together that we actually get the overall picture and start to assemble what the picture of the elephant actually looks like. I like this because my PhD advisor's name is Bhaktan Singaram, and Bhaktan grew up in India, and as a small child ran around in India without shoes on, and he loves both dirty jokes and proverbs, which all the times seem to have some dirty joke ending that he seems to bring into it. I have no idea how he does it. But part of our job as graduate students in Bhaktan's lab was when he was lecturing and he would start to go down these roads with these jokes, was to cut him off. And like from the back of the room, we're like, no, no, not that one, not that one. Which most of the time he'd ignore us and just keep going anyway. But he's very funny. He's just got a fantastic sense of humor. So, okay, let's get back to screen sharing. So if you've happened to transfer to UCSC and you get a chance to take a class from Bhaktan, most of the time that's 143, it would be advanced organic chemistry as a chemistry major going in. Fantastic course. I can't recommend it highly enough. Okay. So we've got the different pieces of spectroscopy here now in their each in their individual own place. And what I want to do is I don't want to analyze fully each piece. I just want to get a sense right now. And we'll take a couple of notes and we'll make a couple of notes of what we see in each spectrum. But I just want to take a look and see what we've got going on here. What do we see in the IR? Shaggy carboxylic acid beard, maybe, with a question mark. I like that. Wouldn't a carboxylic acid also have to have a carbonyl? Oh, Pokey says no carbonyl. Okay, so no carbonyl, which if there's no carbonyl, then that sort of like really raises question marks around what's going on over here, because there should be a carbonyl. 1673 conjugation. Okay, so what does 1673 conjugation actually mean, Keegan?
Maybe it shifted to the right 30.
Your microphone's a little bit low. I'm having trouble hearing you.
Maybe it was shifted 30 degrees to the right.
Oh, it could be. Okay, so that could be a carbonyl, which is shifted. So conjugation. And if it was shifted to the right, that's conjugation at the carbonyl side. Conjugation. So maybe there is a carbonyl. And so we've got some question marks around what that 1673 could be. All right. So we have some ideas of things to look for, but we also have a whole lot of question marks. We don't really know what's going on in here. Percent transmittance is not super great. Yeah, compared to what carbonyls usually are at. Usually carbonyls are strong. Usually we would expect that to be a much stronger peak. Oh, while I'm at it, interesting aside, the IR, in order for a molecule to be IR active, the vibrational frequency has to cause a change in the dipole moment of the molecule. And depending upon the change of the dipole moment that happens with the bond vibration, the molecule absorbs more or less, which is what makes the percent transmittance stronger or weaker. So if the vibrational frequency changes the dipole moment to a great extent, then you get a very strong peak, which is why carbonyls, which would change the dipole moment with their vibrational frequency, tend to be so strong and absorbing, and why carbon-carbon triple bonds or double bonds, which would not change the overall dipole moment of the molecule very much, tend to absorb very weakly, which is really kind of cool. And to Bibi's point, when we were talking about the difference between Raman and IR, the difference with Raman is that Raman is the opposite of IR in that peaks that vibrational frequencies that cause a change in the dipole moment are not Raman active. They don't show up in Raman. What shows up in Raman is changes in the polarizability of the molecule. So vibrational frequencies that change the polarizability of the molecule are what show up in Raman. So they're complementary techniques. They show different things and they can work very well together to look at the Raman and the IR. So some interesting things there. Okay, this is the proton NMR, and I've got a detail section that maybe what I'll do is grab this section and bring it up into this spectrum, and we'll throw it over here. This section is just the two hydrogens that are in here. So the other 1H, I don't know if I grabbed that. I did. Moving these things around is not easy. This one, which is a doublet, is this guy. And then the other ones we don't need details of. And I can zoom onto those as we need to. So when we look at this, what is it that we see in this spectrum here? When you're looking at the parts per million, there's some things that jump out to me in this. What do you guys see? Aromatic, I like that. So that these peaks, I'll switch to green because a lot of my coloring is in red. These peaks here are aromatic. What else? Some roofing with a 3 hertz. Yeah, there's definitely some roofing going on. And they've given me the hertz, which is kind of nice. So I can see the roofing that is taking place in these. And the 3 hertz are telling me that these guys are linked together, that these guys are splitting each other. And the 9 hertz aligns with the 9 hertz coupling constant in here. So that one has the 9 hertz and the 9 hertz here. These guys are splitting each other. So that's helpful that I can just sort of walk through and see what's splitting there. And there is some roofing that's taking place. Some kind of carbonyl near 12, absolutely. This guy that exchanges. All right, so that exchanges is a hydroxyl group or carboxylic acid group. It is some type of OH, and I got to figure out what type, but it's one that exchanges. Okay, this is good. Anything else? Let me remind you that what is not here is sometimes as important as what is here. Four environments, so there's some symmetry. Di substituted, maybe di substituted, maybe not. There's 3 protons that are aromatic. Disubstituted would give me 4 protons that are aromatic. So in terms of substitution, I think I might be trisubstituted. So we can include that in there too, is that this is probably an aromatic ring that is tri-substituted. All right, so what was I hinting at that's not here? This range here, this is the aliphatic range. There's no aliphatic protons. And there's no CH3 groups. Mary's just not liking this. there's no CH2s. There's no CH3s. There's none of that. And there's a peak here that nobody has decided to tell me about yet. We're just ignoring that one for now. But apparently it's not of interest. Yeah, question mark. Okay, we don't know. Can I scroll up? Sure. Let's forget T. Nope, got nothing. Okay. So there's all of that going on. Let me grab, we got 2 more spectra. This is the carbon. I want to get the carbon in there since we sort of did the NMR. So this is the carbon NMR. This guy here is solvent. Okay, anything else coming up in this one? What do we see in the carbon? What looks exciting? What looks interesting? A 190 carbonyl signal. Yeah, okay, so some type of carbonyl. We'll have to figure out what that is. That's good. What else? 7 environments, okay. Remember, I'm just getting an idea and trying to figure out what might be here, what might not be here. I haven't done a deep dive into these things just yet. We did a little bit more in the proton than I had expected, but that's okay. Let's see if I concur with the 7. This would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I agree with that. So 7 environments, I'm liking that. Again, complete lack. This is the aliphatic region. This is the aromatic region. So complete lack of aliphatic, and most of the protons or most of the carbons look like they're aromatic. We got to figure out what that guy is. I don't know what that guy is yet. And then this is the mass spec. -167 is the ion peak. Okay, I'm liking that. What's the base peak? 137 is the base. Good to identify those. Anything else in here jumping out at anybody? As long as we're here, I don't necessarily consider this a deep dive, but let's take a look and see. Going to 150 to 167 leaves me with what, -17? That's an interesting number. 137 to 167, this is -30. Or I could go this way, just curious, what is that going to be, 13? I don't know what the heck is 13. That doesn't sound like it's a reasonable thing. 37 to 20 is also a loss of 17. So I'm seeing that a couple of times. The 167 to 109 equals a loss of 58. That doesn't ring a bell. 167 to 120 is 47. That might be something. So I'm just going through and looking at different things to see what might be here and just running a couple of numbers. The one number that jumps out at me that looks quite interesting is the minus 17 that I'm seeing repeatedly, which is a hydroxyl group. And so the fact that I'm seeing a hydroxyl group kind of pop out in different places, and JC had it in there, that's good, leads me to some interesting questions about what might be going on in this. Ooh, odd nitrogen, Pokey, thank you. That is a great observation. The molecular ion is odd, which implies that there is an odd number of nitrogens. Not necessarily a single nitrogen, it could be three nitrogens. It could be one, three, hopefully not five, because that just starts to get ugly. But we could assume that I'm not going to give you something with three nitrogens in it, because that would just be mean. We can assume that this maybe just has one nitrogen in it. And so, you know, we have done some work here that says that we have maybe two oxygens. And I'm getting to two oxygens in multiple ways. There is one that exchanges. And so that's at least one oxygen that's exchanging. And I have a carbonyl. So that's at least two oxygens that are in this molecule. When I go back up to the IR, the IR showed me something of a carboxylic acid and maybe a carbonyl. So that's sort of agreeing still. The fact that it's conjugated would make sense because it seems like I'm dealing with an aromatic ring system. And so the conjugation sort of makes sense. So I'm starting to get a picture of what this molecule might look like, but it's time to start digging into it now. And before we start going too much further, let's take a look at that formula and start with the rule of 13. So we were at 167. We'll go ahead and we'll use the rule of 13. That's 12. That's 156. Does that give me 11 as a remainder? So I'm at C12, H12 plus 11. So I'm at 23, which is an odd number. And because we've got the odd number there, that was expected because we're expecting a nitrogen. So one of the first things that we should do is we should go ahead and put a nitrogen into this. Nitrogen weighs 14. So what's a carbon and hydrogen equivalent of nitrogen? If I want to add in a nitrogen, I need to subtract an equivalent amount of mass. What is that mass? CH2. Exactly. Thank you, JC. So that gives me C11 and then 21 and a nitrogen. Okay, and we think that we might have at least one oxygen. And so maybe we should take and we should swap out and put in maybe one or two oxygens just to see what kind of happens here. C10. I got to take away 4. So what do I need? Not 18, but 17. NO. We'll do that one more time. Swap out an oxygen for a CH4. So that's going to take me to a C9H13, NO2. Okay, now at this point, I don't know what my correct formula is. There are two methods now to find the correct formula. One method is to use the C13 isotope peak. Now, I don't think it's listed on here what that percent abundance is. But what we could do is we could strike out a straight line And moving that line up, we can create a grid, and we can see that we are just above 5 on that grid. And that is nowhere as close to what that is actually supposed to be. So that is interesting. Because if I did it off of that number, that would suck. I'm going to give you the percentage. The percentage is 3.62. And this one is at 47.0. So we could use the percentage of the C13 isotope peak and the percentage of the molecular ion peak to calculate how many carbons there are supposed to be in the molecule. And so we can come up with a rough estimate of the number of carbons here by taking the 3.62, dividing it by the 47.0, multiply that by 100. That gives me the C13 to C12 ratio in the molecule. And then I divide that by the relative abundance of C13 to C12, which is 1.1. And this should give me the number of carbons that are in the formula. So that's the way that I reconstruct that. So that's 3.62 divided by 47 times 100. Divide that whole thing by 1.1. And that equals 7, pretty close to 7.00. So that tells me that there are supposed to be 7 carbons in this. And I've got 9. So something's not right yet. The other thing that I could do here is I could figure out how many hydrogens there's supposed to be in this molecule. So notice that I can go back to the proton NMR. And because they gave me absolute integrations, I can just read these absolute integrations and figure out how many hydrogens there's supposed to be in the molecule. So the absolute integrations are 2 plus 1 is 3 plus 1 is 4 plus 1 is 5. Apparently, there's only 5 protons in this entire molecule. Or it could be double that. It could be 10. Because if you think about it in terms of if these weren't absolute, if these were relative, then it could be a multiple of that. But I'm going to give it to you that these are absolute. So this is how many protons there are. So that means I've got 3, 4, 5. I've got 5 protons total. So back down here to my formula, and I'll start building from here. The C13 isotope told me that there are 7 carbons. The proton NMR told me that there are 5 hydrogens. The odd mass, the mass spec, with the odd molecular ion peak, tells me that there's a nitrogen that is in this molecule. So I know the formula is C7H5O something N. And now I just got to figure out how many oxygens there are in that, and that whole thing needs to add up to 100 and what was it, 67? Yeah.
I have a quick question.
Please.
Remember this morning when we were doing stuff with alcohol and you were like, sometimes it's odd, but it's not. Like it shows up one less because of the hydrogen. How would you know to distinguish between that and nitrogen?
You wouldn't. You would not. There would be very little way to tell. In reality, we use the different forms of spectroscopy to try to sort that out, and we look for certain things. In reality, we would not work off of 167, but we would work off of the high-res mass spec that would be 167 point something, 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 something. And we would take the high-res data and we would put that into an NMR calculator, a mass spec calculator, and we would ask it to tell us what the formula was. That would not have to rely on any of these other tricks that we're trying to do. And if we had the high res data, and let's say that 167 was not, was a result of losing the proton, right? And so it was an alcohol that lost its proton, or could be a neutral molecule with a nitrogen in it that had lost an electron and then was charged. Those two things would show up dramatically different in the computational component if I had the high-res data and I asked the computer to resolve them. The computer could tell me exactly which one of those was the right one. And I would know whether it was an alcohol that lost a proton, that the whole thing had a positive charge from losing the proton, because I would have an odd number of hydrogens in order to accomplish that from losing the hydrogen, and there would be no nitrogen in it. Or I would have a molecule that would have the nitrogen in it and an even number of protons, in which case I know that the formula was due to having the nitrogen in it. So the high-res data would tell me. I'm not going to give you the high-res data because I don't want you to have to rely on a computer to sort that out. So the agreement is that if it's not the molecular ion peak and it's on a quiz or a test, I will tell you what the molecular ion peak actually is. So I won't make that ambiguous. I'll make that clear.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Just so you're not panicking. Yes, we'll make that clear. But there are ways in practice to be able to sort that out. That's what I want you to know. And right now we're kind of going around that. We're assuming that 167 is the molecular ion and that it's odd and that it's a nitrogen, and we're doing all this other work. So I've got the rest of this work. I've got 7 times 12 plus 5 plus 14. That equals 103. So I'll take and subtract 103 from this, which is going to give me 64. And then I will take and I will divide 64 by the mass of oxygen to figure out how many oxygens are in this. So I've got 64 divided by 16, which is 4. And that's how many oxygens I can expect. And so my formula is looking like, from the work that I've done here, C7H5O4N. And that is my molecular formula. So I've got that. Now that I've got that, now I start down the other things that I know I need to do. Now I start down, Pokey's got it. Pokey was on it. So now, that's good work, Pokey. Now what I've got to do is figure out units of unsaturation. So remember the formula, CN, H2N plus 2 plus however many nitrogens minus however many halogens. And I wasn't seeing any halogens in this. So there could be an iodide or a fluoride, but those are rare. I didn't see any chlorines or bromines indicated in the mass spec. So I'm going to assume that there aren't any. And that means that I'm going to have 2 times 7 plus 2 plus 1 for the nitrogen. That's going to give me 14, 15, 16, 17 for saturation. And I've only got 5. So what is that, 12? Divided by 2 means 6 units on saturation. And that's following along with the fact that I was fairly certain that I had an aromatic molecule. So 6 units of unsaturation is not unexpected. BB, you got 5. Did I do something wrong?
The nitrogen.
Did I mess it up? So when I take and I calculate how many for saturation, I add 1 for each nitrogen.
Oh, no, I messed it up.
Oh, okay. I was just checking.
Makes more sense.
All right, just checking. Keegan, did I say it's rare for fluorine and iodine as the ones we're looking at, or as in any random organic compound you might end up looking at? Fluorines tend to be, and iodines tend to be a little bit more rare. Within natural products, sometimes we will see them, but they are by and far much more rare than seeing a chloride or a bromide. Fluoride is extremely electronegative. And to see it show up in natural products just doesn't show up all that often. Iodide is extremely large and very labile and pops off and eliminates fairly easy. So it's very rare to see iodides as well. It's much more common to see a chloride, which is in period 3 in the periodic table and has orbitals much more along the size of the carbon and oxygen sort of orbitals. And bromide is in that same sort of group when we're period down. So chlorides and bromides, much more common. All right, so we've got units of unsaturation, and we've got a formula, and we've got things to start working on. So at this point, what I would do is go back over my data again and look and see if anything is changing, right? So I'm now dealing with the fact that I have a formula, which is C7H5NO4. And I'm looking in this IR to see if anything has really changed or what I might expect. And the answer for this is, God, I don't know. It's still ugly. It's still not super pretty in terms of me trying to figure out what's going on within this. This 1313 is fairly prominent, but unless I had a good IR table, it's in the fingerprint region and it's not something that I know what it is. This is still looking like a carboxylic acid. And so I'm still leaning towards that, although 1673, I don't know if that matches up with a carboxylic acid going down that far. So there's still some uncertainty here. This, I think it's time to deal with the proton NMR. I think it's time to make a proton table and to start breaking down and making some assignments into what these things are. I think this is a good place to start. And so let's go ahead and do parts per million, integration, multiplicity, number of neighbors, and then assignment. Start figuring out what this stuff is. Okay, we've got the detail. This piece over here, 7.06 doublet, 3 hertz. 7.06 integration, I didn't see what it was, 1, because they were integrated together. See the integration that is here, but this is the detail of that area. They were integrated together initially, but when they did the detail, they broke it out 1 and 1. So I know that those are not two protons in the same chemical environment. They're different chemical environments. And in fact, this also allows me to pick out my number of chemical environments. Maybe I should do that first. This is 1, this is 2, this one's 3. This is a singlet, 4, and this one that exchanges is 5. So there are 5 chemical environments. Which is good because there's no symmetry. 5 protons, 5 environments, every proton is unique. Integration of 1, multiplicity doublet, number of neighbors 1, assignment, it's an aromatic proton. Second one, this is what pattern? Okay, so with this one, I would be careful. If we're calling this a doublet, then this that has a 3 hertz coupled to that and a 9 hertz, this is just a double doublet. It's not a doublet with a long range double doublet. So what's the difference? How do I highlight or see the difference? I'm going to, I guess I have to do it down here. When we look at a signal and I see a signal that has little peaks up at the top of it like this, that may come down, this I call a double doublet, where this is the long range. And that long range is usually a J4, which is generally smaller than like 2 hertz. It's generally pretty darn tiny. When I see something that has drawing challenge now, when I see something that looks like this, that may have 9 hertz here, and from here to this guy here, 3 hertz to that guy. This is a true double doublet where they are both J3s. It's not, the splitting is not occurring just at the tip. The splitting is a deep splitting that goes almost all the way down to back to the baseline. That's indicating that that's a fairly strong coupling and is really just a J3. So I want to make sure that we understand the difference between those two and what we're seeing in this proton NMR. So this is indeed a true double doublet with a 9 hertz and a 3 hertz. So here's what I'm going to do. This is a doublet that was 3 hertz. Then I've got, I don't know what number was it. It's centered on 7.12. 7.121 double doublet. It is 3 hertz and 9 hertz. So they're giving me the constants so that I could go back and figure it out. This is two neighbors, but I'm going to call it a 1+1 because they have different coupling constants. So it's got two neighbors, but it's two different neighbors. And this is an aromatic proton as well. Then I've got this guy, which is here. And this one is one proton that is a true doublet at 9 hertz. And that's at number 8.1. So at 8.1, I've got one proton, doublet, 9 hertz. Okay, so that means that this guy and this guy are talking, and this guy and this guy are talking. And this is an aromatic proton. And and then I've got this that's coming out at 10. Looks like 10 point maybe 2 for one proton that's a singlet. And what is that guy that comes out at 10.2? Anybody got a table?
It's kind of right between like a carboxylic acid and an aldehyde.
Okay, if it were a carboxylic acid, how could I distinguish between a carboxylic acid at that signal and an aldehyde at that signal? What would the carboxylic acid have written next to it that an aldehyde would not?
Exchanges.
That's right. The fact that this does not exchange means that it cannot be a carboxylic acid. Carboxylic acids would exchange because they're protic. And they would swap out in the D2O experiment. So the fact that this one doesn't exchange, and they're telling me that this guy over here does exchange, the fact that this one does not means that it must be the aldehyde. So that's an aldehyde signal. Which, since we're assuming that this is an aldehyde proton, we should go back and we should check that IR and the wavelength for an aldehyde and make sure that that 16, whatever it was, could correspond to an aldehyde shifted if it were conjugated and see that that matches so that we keep trying to correlate our pieces of information. Okay, now let's get this last one. Last one looks like it is 10, 11. That's looking like 11.5. That is up there. It's one proton. It's a singlet. It exchanges. Not seeing any neighbors for it. How do we want to assign that? Anybody see what that might correspond to? Maybe we need a good table. Let's see, we used a table in lab this morning. Let me go back to that proton table, lab notes this morning. It is not on there as such. It's showing as a carboxylic acid or registering as a carboxylic acid. Although I would say it's at the very beginning part of the carboxylic acid.
Is considered the beginning?
Well, no, it's not. It's up there. It's square in the middle of carboxylic acids. Let me see. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo. What do I want? I want a table that I can show you. Let's see. All the way out at 11.
Are you trying to get us to say it's a phenol? Is that the punchline here?
No, I'm trying to see if I'm trying to distinguish it between a phenol and a carboxylic acid.
Okay.
Because phenols and carboxylic acids can overlap and come in the same place. And I'm trying to see if it's closer to a phenol or closer to a carboxylic acid. And none of my tables are doing me justice. I have examples of molecules, and I can show you examples of molecules and show you where it comes, but I don't want to go outside of tools that you have access to. Because if I have to go to tools that you don't have access to, then that's not cool. All right. So we can't distinguish between a carboxylic acid and a phenol. Or can we? Interesting. Okay, I have a plan. Plan is to leave this as a question mark. This could be a carboxylic acid, or it could be the phenol, and we don't know which one it is. Yes, a phenol would exchange. Carboxylic acid would exchange and a phenol would exchange. So they would both exchange. But we've got a carbon table here. We should not be the blind man trying to figure out the elephant. Or we should at least rely on all the blind men to figure out the elephant and put them all together. So let's not rely too heavily on one piece of data. Let's keep going and kind of pull some other pieces of data into it. Okay, so we've got seven environments that were already listed. Let's go ahead and make a list of our signals. We have 114.7, 119.1, 127.6, 134.8, 140.5, 163, and 190.2. Okay. Out of all of these, the 190.2 is a little bit easier to work with. We kind of know what that one is. The 190.2 would make sense if that was our aldehyde. And we could check that on a carbon table. And I think that we would see that 190 would come out close to where we expect an aldehyde to come out. And we know that we have to have six aromatics, right? Because we have an aromatic ring system and there were no aliphatics. So that means that the rest of these, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, these are all my aromatic ones. Okay, so let me go back and ask the question, what is this signal? Is it a carboxylic acid or is it a phenol?
Probably a phenol because there's no aliphatic.
Not aliphatic. There's no second. One carbonyl is taken up 190 as the aldehyde. If I had a carboxylic acid, what would have to happen?
Oh, my bad. I used that word wrong. There's no other carbonyl signal.
There's no other carbonyl signal. If there was a carboxylic acid, you would have a signal that would be up in northwards of 200. And we don't have another carbonyl signal. We're out of carbons. We just used 6 and 7. If we try to include an aldehyde and a carboxylic acid, we would have 8 carbons and we only have 7. And so the carbon NMR gave us the answer. The carbon NMR limited us and told us that there's no carbons left for a carboxylic acid. The formula was C7H, what? I forgot now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. NO4.
Four.
Yeah, thank you. And so, no carbons remaining for carbonyl. So that infers that it must be the phenol signal. So we can come back here and we can say, that must be a phenol. Oh, BB, aldehyde, nitro group, and phenol. Where did the nitro group come from?
Well, you have N and two O's left, and then no other carbons and no other protons.
Excellent. That is outstanding. Okay, so what has come out of this too is that as we're going through here and looking at it, the carbon NMR and the proton NMR are agreeing, and we have figured out that we have an aromatic. There is only 3 protons on the aromatic. It is trisubstituted. In some manner, we don't know what manner just yet. And we have an aldehyde. And we have a phenol. And that leaves me a nitrogen and 2 oxygens and no more carbons. So the only remaining group seems to be a nitro group. So my 3 substituents appear to be the aldehyde, the alcohol, and the nitro group. So now my job is to consider what could possibly be on here. Do we ever consider the possibility that the original organic molecule was a stable neutral radical prior to entering the mass spec? And the answer is no, unless that's the field of research that we happen to be in. So if we happen to be researching stable organic radicals and doing mass spec on stable organic radicals, then yes, but if we're just doing a standard problem that is out of some homework set and we're not researching in that area, then we just assume that it's a regular organic molecule and nothing fancy. Okay, excuse me. So I think we have all of the parts. Now what we need to do is we need to consider our options. First thing that I want to do in considering the options is I would like to nail down the substitution pattern. With 3 protons and 3 R groups, there are 3 possible configurations. I could have the configuration where all the R groups and all the hydrogens are together. I could have the configuration where I get two R groups together. And one R group is off by itself, grouping two hydrogens and one hydrogen off by itself. Or I could get the configuration where every R group is isolated and every proton is isolated. And these are the three different possibilities. Now here's the thing, notice that what I'm doing is not trying to draw every possibility and solve every possibility at once. I am picking one aspect of the molecule to focus on and narrowing down my possibilities on that one aspect of the molecule before creating a more complex thing. Tear it down, focus on small bits that are discernible before you expand out and look at every possibility. So let's just deal with the substitution pattern first and figure out what substitution pattern looks right. Okay, so in doing this, we need to now predict. We need to know what would happen with these three protons in terms of their splitting. What would I assume for this proton? Singlet, doublet, triplet, what do I expect? Doublet, it's only got one neighbor. These two are linked together. What about this guy here? This one down here on the end would be double doublet? That's a doublet. Okay, so yes, if I had gone in order and you were trying to predict what order I would go in, that would be the double doublet. But I went out of order because I was trying to get you to see singlet and singlet. And then this one could be a double doublet or it could be a triplet. And oftentimes it will show up as the triplet more than the double doublet. Okay, what about this pattern? What do I expect for each one of these hydrogens? Each one of these hydrogens should be a singlet. Yes. Can we agree that we don't have singlets? And that this one is most likely out because of its singlets? Okay, let's deal with this one. What do I expect for this proton? This guy over here is connected to these two. So this would be a doublet. And what about this guy down here? Middle option here is also a singlet, good pokey. And this guy down here would be a doublet. Okay. Let's go back up and look at that proton spectrum. This is a 3 hertz signal. This is a 9 3/8 signal. This is a 9 hertz signal. One of the things that we didn't discuss so much, I'm gonna go back to it, see where I've got it. Why are my notes upside down? Hang on. Half my notes are upside down, half my notes are right side up. Ooh, did not want to move that. Okay. One of the things that I'm trying to remember if I told you or not, I gave you the coupling constants for different geminal versus trans versus cis for double bonds. I don't know if I gave it to you for aromatic ring systems. aromatic ring systems, when we look at an aromatic ring system and we look at the protons, these protons will couple here at a 6 to 10 hertz coupling constant. They're very much like the cis, which is 6 to 12 hertz. So on a cis double bond, we generally expect 6 to 12 hertz. This is 6 to 10 hertz in terms of what we expect here. The coupling constant, when we go to a 1-3 proton, these guys here can couple at 1 to 3 hertz. And para can couple 0 to 1 hertz. So this is a true J3. This would be a J4. 1, 2, 3, 4. And this would be a J5. And just showing what the different J values can be. So if it was this configuration and this were 6 to 10 hertz and 6 to 10 hertz, then I shouldn't see anything less than 6 or 10 hertz in terms of my coupling constants. But this one over here, this one could be 6 to 10. And this guy here could be 1 to 3. And then going this one to that one would be 0 to 1, would be really tiny. Going back and looking at the data again, looking at the fact that we have a 9 hertz and a 3 hertz. Does the data that I just helped give any sort of insight into which thing is the right one here? So these two are talking to each other with the 3 hertz coupling constant. And these two are talking to each other with a 9 hertz coupling constant. These two here are the J3. And that 3 hertz is a J4. And so it actually is that this is a double doublet, but it didn't look like that because the aromatic ring gave it such a strong coupling. It gave it a much stronger coupling than what we would normally see. And so it is a J3. And a J4. And it matches the middle pattern. So if we look at this as being A, B, and C, the substitution pattern is B. And now that we have the substitution pattern down, now it gets ugly. You thought it got ugly before. Now it gets ugly now. Now we have an aldehyde. And we need to know whether the aldehyde is next to the nitro. And then the phenol. Or is the aldehyde next to the phenol and the nitro? Or is it that the phenol is here paired with the aldehyde? And the nitro is out? Or the other way around, is the phenol paired with the nitro and the aldehyde is the odd one out, And have I even found all of the possibilities yet? Because for each one of these possibilities, as I've paired them out, they actually have a little bit more complexity than that. Because this could be that the phenol is on this side. Or the nitro is on this side. Or in these guys, let's see if I'm about to double up any. Yes, I'm about to start doubling things up if I'm not careful. And in fact, I did. I already doubled them up. Nope, I need to be more systematic because this guy is the same as this guy here because nitro is across from aldehyde and next to hydroxyl. Nitro next to hydroxyl and across from aldehyde. So I doubled it up. Let me make sure I didn't double up this one. Hydroxyl across from aldehyde. That one is unique. But now I'm not convinced that I got them all. We need to make sure that we get them all before we move on. So let's drop back and be a little bit more systematic. We did these two together, aldehyde and nitro, aldehyde and nitro, and we moved the hydroxyl group back and forth. So that's a pair. We should keep those two together. Then what we did is we took the aldehyde and the hydroxyl group. And I think that the better way to do this systematically is to not move the aldehyde, but systematically keep the aldehyde and the hydroxyl group where it is and just move the location of the nitro. That makes another pair. And then we have the last pair. And this is where we take the hydroxyl group and put it next to the nitro. And then we move the aldehyde. And that should give us all possibilities. So sometimes you have to slow down and figure out what's possible. Okay. So we have a set that we can call set A, set B, set C. And we need to figure out which of these sets is the right set. Scary ideas. Let me ask something else. How confident do you feel in the problem so far? I mean, let's say that this is how far we got, and we got this far on the test, and this was the last problem that was the 44-point problem on the test, that is the last half of the test. How did we do?
43 points.
If this were a 44-point problem, and we go through that rubric. We did everything correct out of that rubric. The only thing that we haven't done is we haven't finally figured out what's here. So out of 56 points, we would have gotten 55.6 points. And out of a 44-point problem, what we would have done is we would have taken 56-point rubric. We would have done it this way. We would have taken 56. I keep trying to do this. What am I having problems with? 55.4 divided by 56 times 44. That's how many points we would have gotten for a 44-point problem. 55.4 divided by 56 times 44 equals 43.5 and greater, and I would have rounded it up and I would have said 44, done, full credit. Well, sure, because we do sick things, right? As far as I'm concerned, you get this far, you have really done what I wanted you to do. You've solved the problem to a degree that has narrowed it down to things that are really hard to get to. Now, we could do this next part, and I want to give you just a little bit more help. Just, I don't know that we'll get down to the final part, but we should just do a little bit more work on what to look for here and how to figure this out. One of the things that I know is I know this proton, because this proton is the proton that is the proton that has the 3 hertz coupling constant. It's the 3 hertz doublet. So the proton that I have labeled, this is the 3 hertz doublet. And the spectrum has that 3 hertz doublet. Let's go back and look at it. The spectrum has the 3 hertz doublet, the farthest upfield. The farthest downfield is the 9 hertz. So it goes 3, then the double doublet, then the 9. So what I'm seeing is, my spectrum is showing me this. Three hertz. Then I get this guy. It's the opposite. This is the 3 hertz. This is the 9 hertz, 3 hertz, double doublet. And then I've got one more, which is up here, which is the 9 hertz. And if I wanted to pick out where those protons were, the double doublet, the green proton, is going to be this proton in each one, because it's coupled to the red. So it is meta to the red. And then the blue proton is that guy. Okay. So BB, so I think the OH ortho to the aldehyde, then the para to the nitro. Oh, but then never mind. Mary's having some epiphanies and then some confusion and then some epiphanies and then some confusion, which is fun to watch. So finding the one that is most downfield, what's the strongest electron withdrawing group in here? Pick the strongest electron withdrawing group. The nitro definitely is the strongest. And then what's the second strongest? That was close. The aldehyde is a good shot, but remember, directly connected to an oxygen is always going to be more electron withdrawing than directly connected to a nitrogen or a carbon. So in terms of electron withdrawing ability, it goes that the nitro is the most. So I'll do it this way. Nitro is more electron withdrawing than the alcohol, which is more electron withdrawing than the aldehyde. And so the one that is farthest downfield, if we look at it, this proton is next to the hydroxyl group. I wouldn't say that's a good candidate. The proton next to the nitro, I would say that's a good candidate for having the 9 Hertz coupling constant down as far as it could be. So I would say that this one is a good candidate because of the location of the proton. And I would say this one is a good candidate because it puts that one proton next to the nitro group that is farthest downfield. And now we've got to decide between those two candidates in picking which one we think is gonna be the better one. And between these two, I would say that it is extraordinarily hard. The difference is that I would say is that if we pick this upper one up here, the red proton and the green proton would be very close to each other because they're both right next to the hydroxyl group. In this one, the red and green proton, the red is next to the hydroxyl, but the green is not. So the green and red would be farther apart from each other. And there would be bigger differences between the green and the red. Look at the spectrum and look how close the green and red protons are to each other. They're right on top of each other. They're in the exact same chemical environment. The fact that they're right on top of each other, this makes them look like they're far apart, but they're right on top of each other. The fact that they're so close means that they're almost in an identical chemical environment, which would lean me towards this choice, picking the green and the red being in the same chemical environment. So blue next to nitro, green and red both flanking hydroxyl. That's what I would go for. And I always like to look at the answer after I've done it. And so I've wiped out this one. And all of these I wiped out because they didn't agree with what I was looking for. And that's the last one that I had. Okay, so let me see something. This was number 12. There's number 12. The hydroxyl peak is across from the nitro. The nitro and the aldehyde are together. And the hydroxyl is one carbon away from the aldehyde. There's one proton. The two protons are in between the nitro and the hydroxyl group. Let's go back and make sure that's what we chose. Two protons in between the hydroxyl and the nitro. One proton in between the hydroxyl and the aldehyde and nitro are next to each other. That is, in fact, the correct answer. Okay, so this is much harder than anything I'm going to give you. But I wanted you to see how we tackle a harder problem. And I wanted you to see that it's not a linear process, that I bounce back and forth between the different spectra. You have to use all the spectra. You have to you have to go back and forth a lot. And then when you're narrowing down your possibilities, don't try to draw all the possibilities all at once. Pick one thing. Like if there's a double bond in the compound and you're trying to figure out whether it's cis or trans, focus on that first. And then focus on other aspects. If you're trying to figure out your aromatic ring, focus on figuring out your substitution pattern. Then move on to how the substituents fit in around it. Pick manageable things to deal with first. Go back to the spectra and figure out how you're going to ascertain the difference between those and then resolve it. And then when you get down and you're at that endpoint where you just got to put all the substituents on, do it as systematically as possible and get each possible compound. Take the one spectra that is going to help you to ascertain the difference between them and dig in deep into it, into what is your strongest electron withdrawing group? How to rank the electron withdrawing groups? What is the pattern of the protons that you're seeing? And what would you expect from the molecule in order to fit that? And you put them all together. And so I just, as the last one, I just wanted to pick like one of the hard ones to go through and show you how we would go through and do that systematically. And so I think this was a good one to end on. Okay. I've already kind of gone over time. If there's some short questions, I'd love to take some short questions. And otherwise, what I'm going to do is for the afternoon lab, I'm going to remind you all that I'm going to put the morning's lecture up before I go to my doctor's appointment. And then that'll be available to you. So you'll be able to go ahead and watch that one. That one had a great problem. It wasn't quite as hard as this one, but it was on the scale of this one. And it was a great example of another great example of how we walk through and how to use the data to pick between the different elements and breaking them down into subgroups and deciding on the subgroup part each time the group gets smaller and smaller until we can find that one thing that discerns between two or three molecules. So this morning's lecture was a really, really fun one too. And it was a problem that I had never done before. And so it was extra fun in going through and walking through one that I hadn't done before. Okay. So any questions come up that I can deal with real quick?
I've got a super quick question.
Go, JC.
Okay, so I got to turn on my thing. I'm going to try to see if I can make this work. I try not to follow the tables with like a whole lot of rigidity just because I know that things change. But in this morning's lab and lecture, I've noticed like, oh my God, for the,
I can see it.
Yeah, for the phenols, like the range is so much lower than what we've been looking at. So like, should I just kind of pencil in like, look over here too?
That's a great question. And I never thought of the phenols as being that far down there. I guess it depends. Yes, it depends. It depends.
Is it because this phenol is connected to a bunch of other electron withdrawing groups?
Yes. Okay. That's where I was going to go with that. That's a great question. Okay. Remember your acidity chapter. If we take a phenol and we're looking at the partial positive here, and we want to know which of the phenols is most acidic, this may have a range that is like 5 to 3 ppm. But the minute you take and you put a nitro group on it, particularly para, away from the phenol, and then you put in another aldehyde in there too, another electron withdrawing group, these are two strong electron withdrawing groups. And what they do is they turn this into an acidity monster. I mean, you took something that was a pKa. This thing had a pKa that was right around 9, 9.5. And now you've turned the pKa into something that is probably around 6 or maybe even 5. And remember that on a carboxylic acid, the pKa on a carboxylic acid is pKa 4.5. So what happened with these electron withdrawing groups is that we just pulled this thing down into the same acidity as a carboxylic acid, which is literally de-shielding it to the same degree as a carboxylic acid, which moved it all the way downfield. So BB is right on the money there in terms of the electron withdrawing groups and what they're doing to that phenol. So JC, excellent question. And you're right on top of it and doing exactly the right thing. And BB, thank you for the insight and the focus on the electron withdrawing groups.
All right, thank you.
Okay, yeah, you guys are on it. You guys are working really hard. I appreciate all the work that you're doing. Okay, that was a great note to end on. I'm gonna go ahead and cut it here and I wanna make sure I get that stuff uploaded. So I'm gonna focus some time on getting that uploaded before I go to the doctors. And I will see you guys either office hours on Monday we're back for lecture on Tuesday, where we get to start some new stuff. So new things coming on Tuesday. Thank you. You guys take care.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.